Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X, and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I am an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as he typically does on days like this, not rainy ones, but the days we do the podcast, although today is both, senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
Of Herbert West, who was my friend in college and in afterlife, I can speak only with extreme terror.
Ooh, that's a good one to start today.
Yes, today we wanted to talk about a subject that is pretty terrifying. We're talking about nuclear weapons.
Yes, yes.
Nuclear, not nuclear.
I was teasing him about this before, and he said that I better not. So I'm not going to say nuclear, I mean, other than just then. Well, one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this today is because it's been in the news a lot lately. Iran is rumored, or depending on whom you ask, more than rumored to be working on a nuclear weapons program.
Yep.
And that's been a busy topic. I was about to say a hot topic. Let's not go there. Lately, and I thought, well, you know, why don't we? We've never really talked about the technology that makes nuclear weapons possible.
Yeah.
And while I'm not particularly fond of things that cause death and destruction, the actual bombs themselves, how they make them work, is kind of interesting.
And it's important stuff. I mean, you know, there are a lot of discussions about nuclear arms races. You know, we had a famous nuclear arms race between the Soviet Union and the United States during the Cold War.
Right.
Started to look like things were going to improve, where, you know, both nations were starting to dismantle a lot of their nuclear weapon programs. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But then you've got other countries like China and India and Pakistan and other countries that have either a nuclear weapons program or are developing it. North Korea is another good example.
Mm-hmm.
They either have a fully fledged out nuclear weapons program, or they're working on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it adds a lot of concern because these weapons potentially pack an enormous punch. And it's the kind of weapon that, you know, most weapons, you use them and then the that immediate moment, the aftermath, you know, that's all you're dealing with. And the
right.
aftermath is generally, you know, not something that is perpetual, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you might have to do some massive cleanup or whatever, but that's it. Nuclear weapons are different in that the aftermath can be as destructive, or maybe not as destructive, but destructive on their own beyond the initial blast.
Right.
And so...
Plus, it's possible that the effects of the nuclear blast can carry across the terrain to places that as we'll find out in our discussion, that people may not necessarily have been planning on being affected.
Yeah, you might, you know.
It's not just the immediate area necessarily.
Yeah, it's not a precision weapon in that, there's a precision blast area that you can be pretty sure is going to be vaporized when you hit it.
Right.
But then there's a large area around that, depending upon the climate and, you know, the specific weather conditions at that time.
Yeah.
It could affect neighboring countries, you know, essentially innocent bystanders to whatever
mm-hmm.
it is.
Sure.
So let's get into this. Let's talk first about atoms.
Yeah. I mean, you think about it. One of the fascinating things about this is that such a devastating reaction can be caused by something as tiny as an atom.
Yeah. And just so that we all have our little refresher course, even though I'm sure no one listening needs it, your basic atom has a nucleus that is orbited by electrons. Now, your electrons are your negatively charged particles.
Yes.
Your nucleus typically contains at least one proton. Actually, it has to. Otherwise, it's not an atom.
Good point.
So the proton is a positively charged particle, and the proton's positive charge and the electron's negative charge are attracted to one another.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty powerful. Now, there can also be in that nucleus a particle that carries no charge at all, a neutron,
right,
which has no charge. And neutrons kind of act like glue for protons because, you know, you've got this nucleus that could have more than one proton. Well, the problem is that similar charges repel one another.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have two positively charged particles and you try and put them close to each other, they're going to start repelling each other. Well, neutrons kind of act like a glue that allows these protons to group together to form this nucleus.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So if you've...
I'm getting out of here. No, it's all right. It's all right. Okay. That's okay.
Now, you can change the number of neutrons that are within an atom.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, atoms have... Typically, they have a number of neutrons that you will naturally find within the atoms of that element.
Right.
If you find something that's outside of that, that either is has more or fewer neutrons, it's an isotope.
Right.
So isotopes of atoms are atoms that contain a different number of neutrons than you would typically find them in nature.
Right. Plus, I think the isotopes are a baseball team in Springfield.
That's also true. Now, this is not to be confused with ions.
Right.
An ion is an atom that has either gained or lost an electron, and so it either has a positive charge or a negative charge because of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, of course, if it's gained an electron, then overall the atom has a negative charge. If it's lost an electron, then overall the atom has a positive charge. So that's the difference between ions and isotopes. Now, isotopes really, that's what ends up being important in these nuclear weapons. It's sort of a key feature.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that's important to note is that for the most part, atoms are pretty stable.
Yes.
I mean, once you get them in their natural state, they're unlikely to change all that much. They don't randomly shed electrons or other things unless some force acts on them. They just sort of go along about their business and stick to themselves.
Right, because if they were unstable, if they were unstable, they would change to become more stable.
Right.
Over time. That's what we call decay.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have an atom that is unstable, it will eventually change to a more stable form. And in the process of that, it's going to give up some energy.
Mm-hmm.
It can give up energy in multiple ways. There's actually three main types of radioactive decay.
That's right.
There's alpha decay, which is where you've got your nucleus and it's going to kick out two protons and two neutrons bound together, which is also called an alpha particle. Then you've got beta decay.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where a neutron actually changes, becomes a proton. The proton and an electron and an antineutrino are all ejected together. That's the beta particle. Or actually the ejected electron is the beta particle specifically.
Right.
Good old antineutrinos. I tell you, they go opposite as the speed of light. So we talked about the whole neutrinos, whether or not they were going faster than the speed of light with Large Hadron Collider. Right now it looks like they didn't. Looks like that was all due to issues with the measuring technology.
Yeah, looking at the scoreboard today.
Right, which could change by the time this podcast goes out. So the third type is spontaneous fission. Now, fission is where you have a nucleus split into two pieces.
Yes.
It's the opposite of fusion. Fusion is where two nucleuses come together and join. And in both fission and fusion, you have a release of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for radioactive decay, we're specifically talking about fission, not fusion.
Right.
So in this, the nucleus splits, and it might eject neutrons, which can become neutron rays, and it also can emit electromagnetic energy called gamma rays, which do not talk about Fantastic Four.
I wasn't.
You're looking at me like you're going to talk about the Hulk.
I was waiting for you to make that joke.
Actually, I think it was cosmic rays for the Fantastic Four and gamma radiation for the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah.
I don't want to get my science wrong.
You're absolutely scientific.
My air quotes science. Wrong. Gamma rays, it's interesting that they are the only type of nuclear radiation that comes from energy rather than particles.
Yes.
All right.
I bet you learned that on HowStuffWorks.com.
Yes.
There's a really good article about that.
We have a couple of articles on HowStuffWorks.com that are going to be really useful as we talk about this. They include how nuclear weapons work, how nuclear radiation works.
Yes.
And also how there's an article about the Manhattan Project, and we'll talk about the Manhattan Project in a little bit.
Yeah.
So we've now got these three different forms of radioactive decay, and we know about the spontaneous fission. Well, what's interesting is that the fission doesn't necessarily have to be spontaneous. If you find the right kind of unstable atom and you are able to bombard it with neutrons, then sometimes those atoms will accept a neutron. And in the process, they will become so unstable that the nucleus itself will split apart.
Mm-hmm.
And in that process, the nucleus will release energy. It also may release other neutrons, which means that if you get a bunch of these unstable atoms together and you shoot a neutron at them, and then that first nucleus splits apart and more neutrons split off of it, it can cause more of these unstable atoms to do the same thing, and that's where you have a chain reaction.
Mm-hmm. I can't remember who it was that had that the TV show where they had a clear plastic box, and on the bottom of the box they had mousetraps.
And each
mousetrap had two ping pong balls on it, and those represented the stable. Actually, it's probably been done by 500,000 people.
Yeah,
anyway,
you can find clips of this same sort of thing on YouTube.
Yeah.
And done by lots of different people.
And I enjoy watching it because it's really an excellent demonstration. So each of these mousetrap atoms with its two ping pong balls represents these unstable atoms.
Right.
And the
ping pong balls represent the ejected neutrons.
Exactly, exactly. And so somebody else will drop a ping pong ball inside a small hole in the box, representing the neutron in this case that is bombarding these atoms. And as soon as it hits one mousetrap and sets it off, the ping pong balls from that one fly in other directions, thereby setting off the other mousetraps. And it all happens in a very, very short period of time. It takes almost no time at all for this thing, for all the mousetraps to release their ping pong balls.
Yeah. Now, in the case of a nuclear weapon, these reactions are happening in billionths of a second.
Yeah.
So now let's get to the actual elements that are used in nuclear weaponry.
Okay.
So one of them is an isotope of uranium, uranium-235.
Yeah, that's a very complex atom.
Yeah, it's got 92 protons, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's got 143 neutrons. And the thing about this is that it will accept a neutron. If you bombard uranium-235, it very easily will accept that neutron.
Yeah, I'll take that neutron.
Yeah, and then it makes the uranium unstable, and then it'll split apart, like I just said, and you'll get that energy and those other neutrons released. So that the problem with this, many problems with this. One of the issues that the people who first started working on nuclear weapons technology encountered was that, first of all, they weren't sure which elements were going to react this way, because not all of them do. So finding the right elements was tricky. The other part is that uranium-235 is relatively rare compared to other isotopes of uranium.
Yeah, that's right.
So when you find naturally occurring uranium, the uranium-235 in that deposit is going to be relatively sparse. And for a nuclear weapon to work, you need about 90% uranium-235.
Mm-hmm.
So that you have the right amount of material to perpetuate this chain reaction. Otherwise, your atoms that are unstable may be too far apart from each other for that chain reaction to really take off.
Note to all the nuclear physicists who have paused the podcast and wrote in to tell us that there are other types of fuel that can be used for nuclear weapons. Yes, we know that.
Yeah.
However, we're starting here.
Yeah, starting with uranium, because that's where the scientists started.
Yes.
Plutonium also used, as well as there are hydrogen bombs that we'll talk about in a little bit.
Yep.
But even hydrogen bombs use uranium and plutonium. It's just that they're using a different mechanism. They're using fusion as opposed to fission. So uranium-235, you have to actually refine your uranium. Wow, I can't talk today. But yes, you must take.
It's not easy to say. Uranium.
Your uranium. Yeah. Toy boat. Anyway, you have to take this uranium. There we go. That works. And refine it so that you have a higher percentage of uranium-235, which is what you hear about when you hear about these nations like Iran, with their nuclear program.
Mm-hmm.
You hear about, are they making uranium for power facilities, or are they trying to make weaponized uranium?
Yeah. This is talking about the enrichment process.
Yes. So if you are enriching, if you're creating uranium so that you've got a section of uranium that is 90% uranium-235, that's indicative of a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
That's not, you don't need that kind of concentration for a nuclear power facility. So that's one of those things that inspectors try to determine when they go and look at a nuclear power facility to make sure that the uranium being produced is not weapons grade uranium.
Right.
So anyway, that's the basis. That's the basic science behind the fission part of nuclear weapons. And we'll get into fusion in a second. So, how did this all come about? Well, first, we have to look at a fellow named Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Einstein came up with that famous equation, E equals mc squared.
The theory of relativity.
Which states that energy is equal to mass times the speed of light squared,
mm-hmm.
the constant of the speed of light, through a vacuum, as it turns out. So that means that you take a unit of mass,
mm-hmm.
you multiply it by the square of the speed of light, speed of light squared rather.
Right.
And then that's how much energy you get from that mass.
Mm-hmm.
So this tells us that a tiny little bit of mass could equate to an enormous amount of energy because you're multiplying that unit of mass against a huge number.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that starts leading people to think, well, if this is true, then there should be some way to tap into the stuff that's around us and get at huge amounts of energy. And you had a lot of really, really smart people working on this. And most of them were probably, at least initially, working on this as a way of finding a new energy source.
Right.
Not necessarily a weapon. However, World War II really helped push the research towards finding a way of using this in a military application as opposed to just a power generation alternative.
Mm-hmm.
So then we go up to the 1930s. You've got a fellow named Enrico Fermi.
Mm-hmm.
And
I had a report on him in grade school.
Oh, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who discovered that if you were to shoot neutrons at atoms, you could sometimes form new elements. And they were including ones that just did not show up on the periodic table at all.
Mm-hmm.
So most of these are atoms that are so unstable that, you know, they almost immediately decay.
Right.
But he discovered that. And then a few years later, a pair of German scientists, Otto Hahn and Fritz Strassmann, discovered that by bombarding uranium with neutrons, that they could cause the uranium atoms to split. So they're the ones who actually connected the concept of fission with shooting neutrons at an isotope.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually created a radioactive barium isotope once they did that. And that's how they discovered, oh, you know, this is what happens if you do this. Then you have a couple of other – there are so many famous names that we could mention that worked on this. But Niels Bohr and John Wheeler started to theorize that if you were to create a fission reaction within enough of this material, you could cause a chain reaction. And if you were to contain this in some way, you could have a controlled nuclear reaction, which would generate huge amounts of energy. Now, a controlled nuclear reaction could allow you to have power, or a controlled nuclear reaction that then results in an uncontrolled explosion is a weapon. It's a bomb.
You know, I'm sort of reminded of our discussion of quantum computing, which also works with atoms. But the thing is that figuring out the predictability, if you happen to listen to that podcast, of where the particle will go and in what direction, is not always possible. That's one of the things that makes quantum cryptography so useful. But yeah, in this case, it's kind of scary, because if you imagine that this reaction is going to unleash a large amount of power, or maybe it won't, you know,
yeah,
that can be a little scary, because you don't know for sure exactly what's going to happen when you do this, which is why, you know, they started doing experiments like, you know, Columbia University in 1940, up in New York. They were starting to mess around with this to see if they could make it work.
University of Chicago squash court.
Yes, yes. Now, that's funny, because of underground,
yeah,
underneath a famous stag field there at the University of Chicago, they were Enrico Fermi finally got it to work,
yep,
in a controlled situation.
Nuclear chain reaction, yeah.
So, you know, again, what if it weren't controlled? That might have been a little scary, but, you know, he got it to do what they thought. And this was important because, again, this is 1940. They realized that this could be a seriously potent weapon,
yeah,
that they could be building. So they realized that if they could harness this and do this in a controlled way, you know, then they could turn it to their advantage.
Around the same time that work was being done on uranium and nuclear fission, scientists over at the University of California at Berkeley, back in 1941, discovered a new element, element 94.
Mm-hmm.
And they thought that this could also work as a potential fuel for nuclear chain reactions. And this element they named plutonium.
Mm-hmm.
And
named for the dog?
Yes, it was named for the dog. It was named for the Roman god.
Yes.
But it was a year later they had actually produced enough plutonium to finally do some experiments on it, because it was not something that was easily found, which, mm-hmm, I guess we should all be thankful for. They figured out that plutonium also would undergo fission when bombarded by neutrons.
Mm-hmm. You know, we should talk about the criticality of the atoms themselves.
Sure.
Because the thing is, say you have your crate of mousetraps and ping pong balls, you have to make sure that nothing is going to set it off before you mean to set it off.
Yeah, you don't want to have something jostle that system and have it all go off prematurely. And of course, with a nuclear bomb, this is truly important because of the enormous amount of damage that it could cause. Mm-hmm. So
working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. on the network that covers more roads than any other carrier. Take your work on the road, and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is, experience. And you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's C-O-N-C-U-R.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, so there's a couple different concepts here. There's a concept called critical mass, which is the minimum amount of mass necessary for you to have a sustained nuclear fission reaction.
Yes.
And then there's the subcritical mass, which is where you've got lower than that amount. And ideally what you want is to have lower than that amount up until the point where you actually want to detonate the bomb.
Yes.
Because that's going to keep it as safe as you can get it. So there were a lot of challenges in trying to find a way to create a bomb where you had the material set up as subcritical until the moment of detonation where it would convert to a critical mass so that that nuclear reaction would remain sustained within it. Otherwise, your bomb would still be dangerous. It would still emit radiation. It would still emit a lot of energy. It just wouldn't cause as much damage as it was designed to do.
Right. Now critical mass is, as Jonathan said, the minimum amount needed to achieve the fission reaction. Now, ideally, for a bomb condition, if you're trying to do this, you would want the fuel to be in a supercritical mass, which basically means there's more than enough necessary to achieve the fission reaction. Because in this case, it just supplies in plenty. You want to make sure that it's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. You don't want to have it where through some weird set of circumstances, just some improbable but possible outcome that the bomb, that a smaller percentage of the reactions takes place than you had anticipated, because that means that the effect is going to be smaller than you had anticipated.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And if you're going to be building something as nasty and dangerous as a nuclear weapon, you kind of want it to be effective.
Yes. Yeah, the point is, again, to operate it when it's going to achieve the desired effect and not before. And
which is really – I mean, this is where it gets hard to talk about this, because the desired effect is so – mind-numbingly awful.
Yeah, I'm trying to speak of it in a clinical sense.
It's a little rough. So there are two different ways to create a supercritical mass within a fission-based bomb.
Yes.
And actually, both of these ways were used in the first two nuclear weapons ever actually used in battle.
One of the things that I think of is again, in a clinical sense, but it's still kind of amusing to me as in reading about this, the nuclear weapons that were detonated in Japan to, or I should say over Japan to, end the Second World War were really, I mean, it seems like, well, they did what they were intended to do, but, they were really more like lab experiments packed in a case and created. So, I mean, now things are pretty standardized, but those two weapons were very different
right.
in the way they did things. And really the scientists weren't 100% certain that they were going to do what they thought they were going to do.
Yeah. And those two weapons were called Little Boy and Fat Man.
Yes.
And Little Boy was the one that was dropped on Hiroshima on August 6, 1945. And Fat Man was dropped over Nagasaki on August 9th. So these two use two different methods to initiate this supercritical mass and begin the nuclear fission process.
Right.
The Little Boy used what is called a bullet.
Mm-hmm.
In order to start this whole reaction, you have to have something that's going to create neutrons.
Mm-hmm. And in this case, it actually was a bullet, although not, you know, in the sense of a gun. The gun that fired it was not the kind of gun that we would think of necessarily.
Right. This was so you take a ball of uranium-235.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And then you take a small amount of that 235 out as a bullet. It's a projectile.
Mm-hmm.
It's placed at one end of a long tube. It's got explosives behind it. So when the explosives go off, it propels the bullet down the tube until it impacts the sphere of uranium-235 at the other end. And here's what happens. The explosives fire, the bullet goes down the barrel, the bullet hits the sphere, and it hits a neutron generator. Like I said, you have to have neutrons to start this fission process.
Right.
So just dropping uranium-235, that's not going to cause a huge explosion.
Mm-hmm.
But by creating these neutrons with this neutron generator, it ends up starting off that series of reactions within the bomb.
Right.
So once those neutrons are generated and it starts hitting the uranium-235, the fission reaction begins. The individual atoms of uranium-235 start to split, and they too start to eject neutrons,
mm-hmm.
which causes more uranium-235 to split. And that reaction continues, and the energy builds up until the bomb explodes.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the Little Boy version. By the way, in case you're wondering how little Boy was, it was able to drop a bomb that was equivalent to 14.5 kilotons of TNT.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, no. 14.5 kilotons. Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry. I misread my own notes.
Yeah. So, yeah. So little is a relative term. Mm-hmm. And then we have Fat Man. Now, Fat Man used an implosion-triggered bomb.
Yes.
So this is different from the bullet method. And what happens here is you've got a sphere of the nuclear fuel. So in this case, again, uranium-235. And then you have a plutonium-239 core inside that. And surrounding the 239 core are some explosives.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is in this bomb, the sequence of events is the explosives around the plutonium fires, and that creates a shockwave. The shockwave ends up compressing that plutonium-239. And that compression is what triggers the fission reaction within the plutonium. That reaction becomes a chain reaction again, and the energies build up, and then the bomb explodes.
Mm-hmm.
So The whole way that this works is that it creates and then directs that shockwave from the initial explosion to generate that first fission reaction that becomes the chain reaction. So yeah, a little different from the bullet method. And it was interesting, you know, both of these methods were being worked on at the same time during the Manhattan Project.
Mm-hmm.
And actually the implosion triggered bomb, as I understand it, was the very first method that was tested. It was the Trinity bomb that mm-hmm. was tested back in Los Alamos, which was not a prime real estate back in that time because of all the nuclear testing they did.
Right.
In fact, back when they did that first nuclear bomb test, no one really knew what the result was going to be.
Right.
I mean, there's just no way of knowing. And it turned out that several of the scientists who were observing the nuclear bomb test back in Los Alamos temporarily lost their vision because the explosion was so bright that it damaged their eyes. But they were able to recover their vision after a while. But people didn't know how powerful this was going to be, how intense the energy was going to be. And so they were viewing it with their naked eye.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out to be a mistake.
Right. And, of course, an explosion of that magnitude also spreads radioactive material over a very large physical space. So, you know, we were talking about that a few minutes ago. When there is a nuclear explosion like this, if there is – you know, it spreads nuclear material out over an area. Basically, you could think of it in roughly, if you're taking weather out of the picture,
yeah.
You know, you would have a huge circular-ish area, over which this material is spread. Now, of course, if the wind is blowing, or the temperature is right, the material can drift along with the wind. Mm-hmm. It can, get into water supplies, it can, you know, cover, it can move quite a bit. And, you know, the effects, the physical effects, of course, there can be a lot more than, vision problems. I mean, there have cancers been attributed to it. There have been cancers attributed to it. And many, many other physical conditions, related to that. So it's not just the people who are, atomized, if you will, by the bomb, right as they happen to be in close enough proximity that it can have long lasting effects on many, many other people and can make the area radioactive for many, many years to come.
Yeah. These elements that are experiencing radioactive decay, they can be in this state for hundreds of years, yeah, depending on the materials. If you were at ground zero of a nuclear explosion.
Yeah. Which is essentially right at the center of the explosion,
yeah,
if you will.
The location of the detonation, essentially. The thing that would kill you would mm-hmm. be the heat.
Yes.
The heat would be so intense that you would be essentially vaporized.
Mm-hmm.
But following the heat is the pressure that's created from the shock wave of the explosion.
Yes.
And so let's say that you're far enough out where you're not going to be vaporized by that heat. That pressure could be enough to knock over the building you're in totally. It could crush you.
Yes.
So you have that to look forward to. Then you've got, like Chris was saying, the radiation and the radioactive fallout. So you can think of that as sort of a bullseye target, right? Like the very center of that target is where the heat is going to be the most intense.
Mm-hmm.
Just outside of that is the general area where the pressure from the shock wave is going to be intense enough to be deadly.
Mm-hmm.
Just outside of that is the radiation, where the radiation could be strong enough where you could suffer severe radiation sickness,
mm-hmm.
Just from the exposure from that.
Sure.
And then the radioactive fallout could affect the largest area.
Right, right.
And like you were saying, the weather can end up carrying particles that have mm-hmm. This radioactivity to them and contaminate other areas miles and miles away from the site of the bombing.
Mm-hmm. It can affect living cells, preventing them from behaving normally. I mean, it can cause birth defects in future generations. So this is very, very serious stuff, of course. Now later after one of the things that they realized after, using these weapons was these fission bombs work very well. Obviously they're very effective, but, they began thinking that, perhaps fusion would be a more effective or create a more effective weapon. And that's the course they began following.
Right. And they, in some cases, they first started looking at fusion back in 1943. There was a physicist by the name of Edward Teller. And yes, he came up with an idea called boosting.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a process where you create a fusion reaction in order to generate neutrons. And those neutrons then go on to create a fission reaction.
Yes.
So
it's really both.
Yeah, it's a hybrid, really. Now, like we said, fusion is where you've got the two atoms that combine together to form a heavier single atom. And in that process, it gives off quite a bit of energy. And you can use different kinds of atoms to do this, but typically in a thermonuclear weapon, we're talking about hydrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And hydrogen has different isotopes, right? There's deuterium,
mm-hmm,
and tritium.
Yes.
And this is all talk. Normally, a hydrogen atom just has the one proton.
Yes.
But if you start adding neutrons, then you get deuterium and tritium. And deuterium is stable. If you have a deuterium atom, it's stable. It's not going to decay. You can actually create water with deuterium. But it will, in large enough amounts, deuterium is toxic.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something you want to have around you.
Tritium. Is that heavy water?
Is that heavy? You know what? I couldn't tell you.
All I remember about heavy water is, from Batman. TV show. I'm pretty sure that's not very scientific.
But then you think, you know, it would make sense in a sense because deuterium, you've got the neutron added, which means that the actual atom itself is heavier. Which means any molecule created out of that atom that would take the place of the normal isotope or the natural state of that atom would be in turn heavier.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, you can keep talking. This is one of those times when something didn't click to me until we were actually talking about it.
Yeah,
so I'll look, see if I can find something.
And I'm not a nuclear physicist, so I honestly can't answer all those questions off the top of my head. But tritium is not stable. It will decay relatively quickly. So it's a bit of a challenge, but what is it, Chris?
You
were right.
D2O, deuterium. It's water made with deuterium.
There you go. And so trying to create a fusion bomb is a little bit tricky because tritium is one of those elements that is typically used in these, but it is not, it's not easy to store, and it got a very short half-life, so... So if you have this problem with storage and how do you keep tritium stable so that you can have a fusion reaction in order to start off the fission that's going to ultimately lead to this destructive force.
Yes.
Scientists came up with a fairly creative solution. First, they created a lithium deuterate, which is a solid compound, and it does not have the problem of undergoing radioactive decay at room temperatures, at normal temperatures, or even, you know, normal operating temperatures of a nuclear bomb until you detonate it.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Running a business is no cakewalk. There is a ton to keep track of. Employees to keep happy, spending to control, travel to plan, and on top of it all, nobody knows exactly what the future holds. Your finance team always has to be ready to change. But with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. and you can finally say goodbye to the costly mistakes and risks that come from manual work and spreadsheets. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And then with the tritium problem, they began to rely upon a reaction, a fission reaction, which will produce tritium from lithium. So first they have to induce a fission reaction with the lithium, and then the lithium in turn will produce tritium. And then you've got the chance, you got the right elements in place to have the fusion reaction. So you have fission to fusion, to fission again, to boom.
Yes.
It's a little complicated, right? And that fission reaction with lithium, it also gives off a lot of X-rays. And the X-rays are actually what allow the X-rays end up increasing the temperature within the bomb.
Right.
All right? And that increased temperature and the pressures that are associated with it that's the energy that goes into the system that allows fusion to happen. Because this is one of the tricky things about fusion. You got to pour energy into the system in order to fuse two atoms together.
Right, right. And the components of the bomb are separated by casings that prevent accidental or maybe premature detonation. So that initial explosion and causing the X-rays basically causes the deterioration of those materials and allows the bomb to continue detonating.
Yeah. So it's a little complicated to talk about this without an illustration.
Yes.
But the way this fusion bomb would work is that you've got an implosion fission bomb with a cylinder casing of uranium-238, which is acting as a tamper. A tamper is the thing that is controlling this reaction so that you get as much energy involved before it actually unleashes that energy.
Mm-hmm.
Inside that tamper of uranium-238 is the lithium deuteride, and there's also a hollow rod of plutonium-239 in the very center of all that. And then separating this cylinder of a tamper of the uranium-238 from the implosion bomb is the shield of uranium-238 and some plastic foam.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what, once you start detonating it, the sequence of events is that the fission bomb, so that first explosion goes off, and this generates the really intense X-rays, which increase the temperature and the pressure within the bomb.
Mm-hmm.
The shield, that uranium-238 shield with the foam, it actually is what contains that explosion so that it does not prematurely detonate the rest of the fuel. But the heat causes the tamper, that cylinder of uranium-238, to start to expand, and it begins to burn away. It starts to put more pressure on the lithium deuterate. which is squeezed so hard that it causes shock waves that initiate fission within the plutonium rod. So here's you've got your second fission reaction.
Yes.
So you've got the first fission reaction, which causes the shock wave ultimately that begins a second fission reaction within the plutonium rod.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that reaction starts to give off radiation. It begins to expel neutrons, and it also gives off a lot of heat. So now you've got even more heat in addition to the heat that was generated by the X-rays.
Mm-hmm.
The neutrons go into the lithium deuterate, which then combine with the lithium, and that makes tritium.
Mm-hmm.
So now you've got this environment of incredibly high temperature, this incredible pressure, and it allows the tritium and deuterium and also deuterium-deuterium fusion reactions to occur.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got tritium combining with deuterium and deuterium combining with itself in these reactions, which produces even more heat, more radiation, more neutrons. Those neutrons from those fusion reactions induce a final fission reaction in the uranium-238 pieces that are making up that tamper and the shield that's around the whole thing,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, creates even more radiation and heat, and then the bomb goes boom.
Right.
So you've got this series of explosions going on in a fusion bomb, several of which are fission, one of which is fusion. The reason for that, you may wonder, well, why do you need so many reactions to go on for a bomb to explode?
Mm-hmm.
Well, when we were talking about Little Boy,
yes.
The interesting thing to me about Little Boy is that it was an incredibly destructive weapon.
Oh, yes.
But only 1.5% of the material, the fissionable material within that bomb, actually underwent fission.
Right.
1.5%.
So it could have been even more destructive.
Yes. The energy it unleashed could have been orders of magnitude larger than it was.
Yes.
So a fusion bomb is designed in part to try and create as efficient a series of explosions and reactions, really. We shouldn't even say explosions.
Right,
reactions
right.
within the bomb. As many as possible, or as much of that material as possible, so that when it does detonate, it unleashes the largest amount of energy it possibly can for the amount of payload that it has.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this also means that we have been able to reduce the size of the actual payloads.
Yes.
Because we can create just as an effective an explosion, but with a smaller amount of material as we could from several decades ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the weapons these days are far more reliable than those early ones. And we've gone from dropping them from planes to mounting them on cruise missiles and ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, these weapons now travel under their own power at a certain point anyway. And, you know, the ICBMs they actually leave the atmosphere and re-enter the atmosphere. So
yeah.
they can travel very, very long distances that way.
We wouldn't really be able to accomplish that if we hadn't moved to a fusion method where
right.
we could be so efficient with the way that we eliminate the existence of other people on the planet. I hate to put it that way, but you know, ultimately, even though we're talking about something that's really scientific, the application of this is absolutely horrifying.
Yes.
But it's no way to get away from that. But the because if we hadn't done that, if we hadn't come up with the fusion process,
mm-hmm.
then it would be much less efficient, and we might not have the option of putting something on a missile because the payload could be too great for a missile to be practical.
Mm-hmm.
Because at that point, you would have to build a missile that would be able to carry enough fuel so that it could propel both the missile itself and the payload to wherever it is you're going to send it.
Mm-hmm.
And it could just become a matter of scale, and it just would not be – it would be possible but not practical.
Right.
By making it way more efficient, we can now put it on top of lots of stuff, including, you know, not just missiles but – weapons aboard submarines. I mean, that's
yep.
all sorts of stuff, right?
Sure.
So terrifying in a way, but yeah, and we have Einstein to thank for it. So yeah. Next time you see that guy.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to mention too, and we don't have to get into it in great depth because we're getting there as far as time goes, but is the testing of these weapons. Traditionally, of course, as Jonathan mentioned earlier, in the very, very early days before they had been actually used, scientists wanted to test them to find out if it was even possible to make the weapon of mass destruction that they envisioned, to see exactly what it would do, how well it would work. So they did all this testing outside and above ground. Now they've in a lot of cases they've done tests pretty much in all sorts of forms. I mean, they still do them outside, but in a lot of cases now they weapons engineers do this underground. In an attempt to contain the reaction, of course, although it, a nuclear reaction can produce such force that it can vaporize large amounts of rock. So they have to be very careful where they do this. You know, for a long time, many governments around the world would use, islands to test their weapons, places that they felt were, somewhat unoccupied. For example, actually that inspired, the Godzilla series of movies, where a lizard was irradiated, on an island where
it's a great series of documentaries.
Yeah. Documentaries where, the one lizard who was irradiated by this nuclear explosion turns into Godzilla and not, you know, all of the other animals that happen to be living there.
He got just the right amount of dosage.
Apparently so. They've tested weapons underwater, and in space. But people are gradually moving to computer testing, which allows scientists to get a much better idea of how things might work without having to
actually blow something up
and create the environmental conditions, the fallout and reactions that would follow. And they've found that this can be actually beneficial. I was reading an article, I believe it was in the Washington Post, that was saying that computer modeling had allowed engineers to discover problems that they hadn't realized existed with the weapons system that they built, prevented it from becoming, you know, they re-engineered the weapons that were in existence because there was a possibility that it may not, that it may cause problems and wouldn't be as stable. You know, it's interesting, but of course they've found out, through testing that fallout can travel, through air currents and water. I think that's one of the things that leads to, a fear that keeps people from using nuclear weapons more freely, because people really understand now more than they did, years ago, that, you know, this is not something that should be done casually.
Yeah. There's also the fear, the hypothetical nuclear winter.
Yes.
Which,
the particulate matter from multiple explosions, basically causing clouds above the earth.
Right. Which would block the sun's light from reaching the ground, thus killing off a lot of the plant life that depends upon sunlight. And then that ends up killing off the species that all depend on plants, humans being one of them. So it could end up being a global extinction event. It could also be something where it just changes the climate globally, where, you know, we actually do have a really harsh winter because the sun's light just isn't hitting the surface and warming it the way it usually would. And we see things that could point us into, like, suggest that that's true by things like volcanic eruptions, where a lot of matter is ejected into the atmosphere, and it can affect local weather patterns. Now, when we're talking about a nuclear winter, we're talking about something that would last longer than a month or two. So it's one of those doomsday scenarios.
It's a sobering thought, to be sure. It's one of the reasons I'm interested in this is, you know, to see the flip side, you know, the idea that nuclear energy can be used as a very efficient and clean source of power. Of course, we saw, we talked about the Fukushima, reactor last year, right after it happened. But that's not the same as intentionally using nuclear power to cause the destruction of many people. So, it's amazing to me personally that, a little tiny atom can be used to do these amazing things.
Yeah.
Whether they're, you know, and I mean amazing in a clinical sense, good
yeah,
things.
Constructive or destructive. Yeah.
It's amazing.
It is amazing. And we'll probably, I think what we'll need to do is in a future podcast, we'll have to do a full episode just on the Manhattan Project.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at a list of names of the people associated with it, if you've ever taken any classes in physics, you're going to recognize a lot of those names.
Yes.
I mean, the era that the Manhattan Project existed in was remarkable in the sense of it was an unprecedented era of scientific exploration and innovation.
Mm-hmm.
One of those where it was phenomenal the amount of work and scientific discovery that went on at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And in no small part, that was due to things like World War.
Mm-hmm.
You know, World War II was definitely one of the reasons why that those advances were made at the pace they were.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the only reason. It was one of those things where a lot of stuff came together all at once and kind of created this environment. Anyway, that's for another podcast because this one's gone on long enough. If you guys have any suggestions for topics that Chris and I should talk about in the future, I welcome you to email us. Our address is techstuff@discovery.com, or let us know on Facebook and Twitter. You can find us there with the handle TechStuffHSW. And Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Hi, I'm Michael Rappaport.
And I'm Kibi Rappaport.
And together we're hosting Rappaport's Reality Podcast.
We have a passion for reality TV, and we're inviting you into our living room.
We're dissecting the drama, and we're giving praise to the single greatest form of entertainment on television today. That is right. Reality TV is the greatest form of entertainment on television today.
Listen to Rappaport's Reality with me, Kibi Rappaport.
And me, Michael Rappaport, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf-Edam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.